supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams pleaded not guilty to a series of corruption charges when he was arraigned before a federal magistrate today. WHYY's Dave Davies was there, and he joins me now to discuss what happens next. Dave, first, it must have been quite a scene with the DA in court as a defendant. Did you get a sense of his mood?
Yeah, Dave, he seemed relaxed. He was dressed in a dark suit. He was friendly. He was animated, engaged in conversation with others in the court. He knows them all, of course, the prosecutors and the marshals. The charges were read. He pled not guilty, then surrendered his passport and was released on his own recognizance. His attorney, Michael Diamonstein, briefly addressed the throng of reporters outside the courthouse. He said explosive allegations aren't the same thing as proof in a court of law.
Convicted Seth Williams in the media simply because the government makes explosive allegations in a complaint doesn't mean they're going to prove it in a court of law. Seth Williams categorically denies that he's guilty of any crime. We ask only that this rush to judgment stop and that the public recognize that this case is going to be tried in a court of law. That's all I have. Thank you.
And with that, he got into a black Tesla and drove away.
Meanwhile, we've got the top prosecutor in the largest city in the Commonwealth accused of some really sleazy stuff. Can he stay in office for months with this hanging over him?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, the head of the Bar Association and others yesterday have already called for him to resign. Here are the thoughts of Gregory Harvey, a respected election lawyer in Philadelphia.
I think he should resign before sundown. Yes, absolutely. There's no way with that indictment pending that anybody can have any confidence in anything concerning him.
So that's his view. But the fact is that if Williams chooses to, he can hunker down and remain in office. There's simply no legal requirement for him to quit. And clearly he has financial needs, so that $175,000 a year salary is pretty important to him. You know, I have to say, Dave, this won't be easy. I mean, just imagine, every time he goes out in public, he could be questioned by reporters, maybe even taunted by citizens who will quote from these texts that are in the indictment in which he asks for favors and trips and stuff. But he doesn't have to leave. Even if he's convicted of the charges against him, he would forfeit the office only upon sentencing.
Dave, we're in the middle of a campaign to elect the next district attorney. What happens should Seth Williams decide to resign?
Well, in that case, Dave, the judges of Philadelphia's Common Pleas Court meet to decide on a replacement, kind of like cardinals picking a cope. In fact, that's how Lynn Abraham became DA in 1991, held the job for 19 years after that. The person picked by the judges would be the DA until next January. It would be too late for him or her to run in this year's election to keep the post permanently. The filing deadlines have passed. Now, the judges could decide to choose one of the existing candidates for DA for the job, and that would obviously give that candidate some advantage to run as the incumbent, but there would be pressures, obviously, too. They have to run the office. I spoke with City Democratic Party Chairman Bob Brady briefly this afternoon and asked if there's any buzz among the judges about this. He says, nope, he hasn't heard from any of them, which I suppose means they expect Seth Williams to stay.
How peculiarly Pennsylvanian, if I can say it. We had a state attorney general in a similar circumstance a while back.
Yeah, deja vu, isn't it? I mean, Kathleen Kane resolutely held on to her office, even after she was charged with conspiracy, perjury, obstruction. And of course, you know, it was a source of constant controversy and embarrassment for months. But she stayed on until she was convicted. Then the pressure was just too great. She was gone in 2 days. We'll see what happens here.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies on NewsWorks Tonight. In other news today, the region's members of Congress are debating what to do with so-called sanctuary cities, including Philadelphia, that don't fully cooperate with federal immigration officials. More from WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo.
One of the first official acts of President Trump was to sign an executive order to block funding from going to cities and counties that are accused of harboring undocumented workers. On Monday, the Department of Homeland Security released a list of those locales, which included four jurisdictions in New Jersey and 15 in Pennsylvania, including Philadelphia and the four suburban counties surrounding the city. Democrats, Like Philadelphia Congressman Brendan Boyle, say even if cities reversed their policies, it would not make the country safer.
There's no question. If you look at the executive order, if you look at the discussion on sanctuary cities, this has all largely been symbolic. Take, for example, the executive order. That would not have affected one of the 19 September 11th hijackers. That would not have prevented one terrorist attack to happen in the United States between 2001 and today.
Boyle is a little different than many Democrats in that he doesn't like that Philadelphia officials only cooperate with immigration officials when they produce a judge's warrant.
We shouldn't have immigration policy set by any municipality or any state. We can't have immigration policy set by Arizona, Texas, or any city. It's best done at the federal level, and to the best they can, you should have coordination among federal, state, and local officials.
That said, Boyle says the administration's threat and attempts to block large cities from getting federal dollars is counterproductive.
The idea that you're going to strip funding or eliminate a deep amount of funding that goes to Philadelphia for police, for fire, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, that would do nothing but jeopardize the citizens of my city.
Many Republicans disagree, including Congressman Ryan Costello, who represents the suburbs west of Philadelphia.
Well, the counterargument to that would be by not enforcing existing law and thereby becoming a sanctuary city, you're creating a more dangerous environment. So certainly the argument is has some merit in the first instance, but I do think that the counterargument there is the more compelling one.
But Costello isn't pushing as hard on the subject as many Republicans, in part because he doesn't want to see Philadelphia lose resources to combat crime.
I think everybody would like to see existing law enforced and not have cities lose very important criminal justice money, because obviously if you look at crime and where it happens, you know, a lot of cities is where crime rates are higher. I mean, as a Republican who represents suburban Philadelphia, I'm very sensitive to that argument.
While the president is trying to coerce sanctuary cities to comply with federal immigration statutes, Republican Congressman Leonard Lance from central New Jersey says he wishes they would consider taking a different approach.
I would hope that the administration might use the carrot, but I don't think that cities should have their own immigration policy. I think that's a matter to be decided by the Congress of the United States.
But Lance says President Trump's tough rhetoric on illegal immigration seems to be having an impact, because reports are that illegal border crossings are down some 40% this year.
I am pleased that the numbers who are crossing the border from Mexico to the United States illegally, those numbers are down. And I think it has to do with the fact that the president has indicated that he wants to become more serious about that issue.
The next battle over immigration is the president's request for money to build a physical wall along hundreds of miles of the border with Mexico. The proposal is estimated to cost as much as $21 billion. While many Republicans support the president's goal, Lance and others are not excited about the price tag.
We need to enhance security at the border. I'm not sure we need a wall in all places.
Senate Democrats are vowing to block a must-pass bill to fund the government after April 28th if it includes money for a border wall. But they have not made similar threats to block attempts to cut off funds for sanctuary cities. Reporting for WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
New Jersey voters go to the polls June 6th to select the Democratic and Republican candidate hoping to replace Governor Chris Christie. Let's get perspective from Politico NJ's Matt Friedman. Matt, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
You've been watching New Jersey politics for a while, and when you started, John Corzine was governor, and there's certain similarities between Corzine and the Democratic frontrunner Phil Murphy. They both have Goldman Sachs in common. Anything else?
They're both very rich, and they've both donated a large amount of money to Democratic county parties and Democratic candidates.
Review how the doors opened for Murphy. Once upon a time, it was Steve Sweeney and Steve Fulop who were considered the frontrunners.
Yeah, and something happened with Steve Fulop, the mayor of Jersey City, that made him decide not to run. Most people think there was something that sort of forced him out of the race. Murphy was sort of running around the edges with those guys as the two main contenders for a while, but when Fulop went out, the political bosses in North Jersey decided that they wanted to prevent George Norcross, the political boss of South Jersey, the patron of Steve Sweeney, they wanted to prevent Sweeney from picking off some support up north. So they very quickly united around Murphy to prevent a move by Norcross.
Is this a fait accompli, or are there real challengers in the Democratic primary?
There are challengers, most notably Assemblyman John Wisniewski, but so far those challengers haven't really managed to gain much traction. Wisniewski endorsed Bernie Sanders. He was the only New Jersey legislator to endorse Sanders, but Sanders hasn't returned the favor, and he was probably banking on that. So while Wisniewski tried to run to the left of Murphy, it's been difficult because Murphy has gone so far left himself.
Let's bring Raymond Lesniak into the mix.
Lesniak served almost 40 years in the legislature, in the Senate and the Assembly, and has in recent years gone from a reputation as a political boss in Union County and wheeler and dealer to really a champion of liberal causes, gay marriage, ending the death penalty. But Lesniak, once a fundraising powerhouse, has been able to raise very little money and is pretty much already given up on the idea that he raised the $430,000 he needs to qualify for matching funds from the state. It is still pretty early. There's time, but right now nothing seems to have upset the Democratic machine and its backing of Phil Murphy.
On the Republican side, Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno has name recognition, but is she too tied to the Christie administration to gain traction?
It's hard for her. One of her campaign planks is to audit Trenton, and that makes it a little difficult because it's, hey, you've been there for 7 years. How come you didn't call for an audit of Trenton before then? She's been trying to strike out and differentiate herself in several ways. The biggest one is her opposition to raising the gas tax. It's frankly really difficult when you're best known for standing behind Christie to differentiate yourself from him.
And I suppose rival GOP Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli is hoping to exploit that connection.
He is, and he has. You know, he's only been in the Assembly for a few terms, but he has been one of the most outspoken Republicans against Christie, and he has managed to get some county party organization support for his bid. He is nowhere in the polls right now. He's virtually unknown. All the polls are really measuring at this point is name recognition.
Well, you just mentioned name recognition. Let's bring Joe Piscopo into the mix.
Piscopo recently stopped being a Democrat, supported Trump, and wanted to run as a Republican. He didn't get his things in order in time to compete. He is toying with the idea of running as an independent. Whether he could be a spoiler, if it comes down to a few points, then I think a Trump backer is a lot more likely to take from a Republican than a Democrat.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Matt Friedman from Politico NJ. TV producer and game show host Chuck Barris died yesterday at the age of 87. Barris was born in Philadelphia. He grew up in Bala Cynwyd. After graduating from Drexel University in 1953, he entered a management training program at NBC. 4 years later, he moved on to become ABC's director of West Coast daytime programming, though Barris always wanted to create shows rather than manage them. In 1965, he came up with his first The Dating Game. That was followed by The Newlywed Game and eventually The Gong Show. Fresh Air television critic David Bianculli says Barris appeared on the TV scene at just the right moment after a scandal drove network executives to stop producing game shows.
The quiz show and game show in the 1950s were TV's most popular form. The only thing that stopped them was that it was discovered that some of them were rigged, and people were getting the questions in advance. And America was so innocent back in the 50s that the revelation of that was enough to force all of them to be driven from the air, not just the ones that were guilty. So we lost the entire genre for a while in the 50s. In the 60s, we got it back partly through Chuck Barris, who developed a game show setup that was so meaningless and I don't want to say innocent because it was kind of prurient. There wasn't a lot at stake, and it allowed the form to come back. The little silly things that Chuck Barris did, the sophomoric jokes and the leering approach, was very popular. He was, for a while, the bottom of the TV barrel. If you want to call him a pioneer in any sense, it's that we have since discovered lots of ground beneath that barrel.
Terry Gross asked Barris about The Gong Show when he spoke with her on Fresh Air in 1986.
Let's talk about The Gong Show. Now, I know I used to watch Ted Mack's original Amateur Hour all the time when I was a kid, and I used to laugh all the time at the Axon there. And then when your show came on the air, it was a talent show. Were you supposed to laugh at the acts who were on there? How did you dream the Gong Show up?
I thought first that we needed an outlet for talent. There weren't any variety shows, and there weren't any nightclubs anymore where you could go to see singers and comics and magicians and so forth. And I thought there must be out there tons of them. There's just no outlet. And I thought that Gong, it wasn't called the Gong Show, whatever the name was, the talent show, would be the answer. I sold the premise to ABC, the television network, and then when I started auditioning, I realized there really weren't that many great acts, but there was an awful lot of bad acts out there. We went back and said we couldn't do the show, but then as an afterthought, I kept thinking, well, what if we reversed it? What if we did a parody on all these talent shows like Ted Mack and Major Bowes and what have you, and had more bad acts than good, and had this big gong and so forth, and that's how the show came to be.
Chuck Barris, speaking with WHYY's Terry Gross. Edison High School in North Philadelphia is a hub for students with both intellectual and physical disabilities. Many of them struggle to speak or even move. This year, teacher Jeff Gross has been using music to get through to his students. A trio of music therapy students from Temple University visit the class twice a week. They sing songs and help the students master new skills. WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron offers this audio postcard from one session.
I thought we would begin with hello.
Ready, guys?
All right. Hi, hi, hi.
My name is Juan Zambonini. I'm a music therapist and I'm a graduate student at Temple University. The areas that we work here at Edison are for developmentally delayed patients, so we're working on cognitive skills, on communication, and social skills. Especially when there's a problem with communication, music can also help to put things into words and to express things without words, too. That's why it's so valuable for our students here, because most of them don't have language.
Yes. Is that a yes or a no? That's a yes, of course. All right, so Kim, here is the deal. You're going to keep the beat.
It's a very exhausting exercise for her to use both hands. If you notice, she kept her hand clenched to one side to just play with one hand. So I always try to stimulate both hands. So it wasn't as much as do the beat right, as just use both hands to get that interhemispherical connection of left and right. And that's all we cared about at that moment.
About the music therapy, I think about the heartwarming response, the smiles and the enthusiasm. Jeff Gross, I'm a special ed teacher at Edison High School. When you see some of these nonverbal students start to say bye or no, or just, you know, we're talking about inches, not yards here as far as progress goes. And that just, it's incredible. Nothing, you know, I think awesome's an overused word, but it's just, it really is awesome to see that progress.
The sounds of the music therapy program at Edison High School in North Philadelphia. You can read more about the program at newsworks.org/education. Former Phillies pitcher and manager Dallas Green passed away today at the age of 82. Green started his playing career in Philadelphia as a pitcher in the early 1960s, but he's best known for being at the helm when the team won their first World Series in 1980 over the Kansas City Royals. Green is survived by his son, John, who works with the Los Angeles Dodgers organization. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.